Welcome into You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, and of course along the way, if you have any questions, feel free to give us a call at any time throughout the broadcast. You can certainly do that. Or text in your question at 806-745-5800. Of course, Dr. Ben Edwards and Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com, for past archived programs. You can certainly do that. And catch up on past shows and all those kinds of things. Also learn a lot more information about Veritas Medical. By the way, Dr. Edwards, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
I guess you know that KISS is coming back for a performance here in Lubbock.
I did not know that.
It's going to be in March at some point. I don't have the date off the top of my head, but they're doing their world tour, so they're coming back through Lubbock. At the United Supermarkets Arena, and I thought, hey, well, in your office, you've got that
autographed wall,
the original.
1977.
Where Gene Simmons or somebody spray painted. I was like, that is so cool. We need to get him to come by and see that.
Well, you'll have to give me some inside connection there.
I want to do that because that is really cool. I bet they'd be interested to see that.
Yeah, that's kind of
after all these years.
Stunt kind of deal.
And
yeah.
I told Channel 13 about it. They were out here on the show about a week or so ago, and I told them that story, and they were like, "Really? Would he be okay for us to go out there and film that?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so."
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Big
historical point of our building, that and Buddy Holly, legend has it. Now, he didn't autograph the wall, but I've been told he watched a movie, because it used to be the State Theater, and he watched John Wayne's movie, The Searchers, and in that movie, John Wayne says, "That'll be the day," multiple times throughout the movie. So Buddy Holly's friend said, "Hey, you need to make a song with that line being the
That'll be
line.
The day,
and that's
right.
Where that song started, in the old State Theater at 1316 Texas Avenue.
Yeah.
Downtown.
Now
Lubbock,
you're
Texas.
Newly remodeled, a nice, beautiful office space, but I saw that, and I took a picture of it when I was at your office a month or two ago, and so I showed it to the crew at one of the local affiliates here, and they were, we got to go do a story on this.
Yeah.
Yeah, KISS coming back through. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, that's really wild. So, anyway, welcome back to the show, sir. Again, if you have a question for the good doctor, feel free to text or call. You can do that, 806-745-5800. What are we going to get into today and talk about?
Well, I was going to kind of summarize a big talk I gave this weekend at the Weston A. Price Wise Traditions Conference.
Wow.
It was their 20th anniversary, and it was in Allen, Texas, just north of Dallas. And it was a very encouraging time. A lot of the folks that I've interviewed on this show, Dr. Tom Cowan, who actually is next week's guest, I pre-recorded that, we'll play it next week. Dr. Nasha Winters, the stage 4 ovarian cancer survivor who wrote a book called The Metabolic Approach to Cancer and is an awesome naturopathic doctor and just awesome person. She was there giving a talk. Stephanie Seneff, we've had her on the show numerous times talking about glyphosate. Griffin Cole, the dentist that we had on recently. It was just this lineup of these all-stars kind of, and it was so neat to meet them. And to hear their latest stuff that they had to say. And just to hang out with some like-minded folks. And, I mean, the food, usually at conferences, the food's not, it's hotel food, basically. And it could be all right. But these guys, they brought in all local, like Holy Cow Beef served the beef there. But all the local farms around Dallas, there was local raw milk, cheese, and goat, dairy,
Ghee,
the pork and the chicken and the beef from all local farm to table kind of thing, and it was awesome. It was really sauerkraut, they had fermented foods. It was great. We had a really good time. And then my presentation was basically about the loss of resiliency, how Americans have lost their resiliency. And I was just walking through Walmart actually before I came to the show, because I had to go buy a little dolly. We're moving this weekend to a new home, so I needed a dolly to move all these boxes, walking through there to buy one real quick. And just every single person I encountered, it was sad. From the parking lot to the customers, the Walmart workers, just they all look sick. some were bald from chemotherapy. Some were just cachectic. That's where your muscle wasting, your muscles just eating away because of, you're so inflamed and so diseased. Obese, these teenage checkout girls, just 300 pounds. I mean, just the skin, the complexion, everyone was just kind of dragging. There was no vitality. There was no life. There was no glow. There was no health. And it just reiterated to me, the focus of my talk, the loss of resiliency and the loss of wisdom. And there was this wisdom that we used to have. And I think it's divine. The origin of that was divine. And it was passed down generation to generation. And then we've lost that wisdom. We've gone full bore into man wisdom, and I gave examples of that. But so anyways, I was going to summarize that the talk was well received, and lots of people asked for a recording or for the copy of the slides, and so probably we'll just do the whole talk here in Lubbock sometime soon. But I wanted to sort of recap it here on the radio, and I want to start with this passage, not from scripture, but from nutrition and physical degeneration. And I think I've read this before to the audience, but it's a great story, so I'm going to read it again. And this is Weston A. Price. He's the author of this book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. Weston A. Price was a dentist. I've talked about him many times back in the early 1900s. And he started to observe, even around 1920, that Americans were starting to have a little uptick of, for sure, dental problems like cavities and crowded teeth and, crowded needing to pull teeth because the mouth wasn't big enough. But also heart disease and cancer and arthritis, and just these diseases were starting to creep up. So he told his wife, we need to go find some people in the world who aren't getting arthritis and heart disease and cancer and cavities and see what they're doing different. How do they compare to Americans? And so that's what they did for 20 years. They got on a boat and they sailed around the world. From Alaska to the Orient to the South Pacific Islanders to the Amazon, Peru Indians to Africa and Switzerland, and I mean all over, 14 different groups in total. And that's what the book, it's a summary of that 20-year trip, basically. It's an awesome, amazing book, and it's at a time in American history, in world history, that things were changing. Right at that juncture when he decided to do this, you could still find people groups who were eating traditional, native, and living, not just eating, but living in an ancestral way, the way that our ancestors have for years and years and years, for thousands of years, was starting to change. There were some groups in these different populations and countries around the world that were starting to shift into modern eating, modern agriculture, modern food processing techniques, mostly the enriched flour and sugar consumption. So it was this unique time where certain groups were transitioning to a modern diet. You could still find groups eating an ancestral diet, so you could compare and see. And before I read this passage, one thing that struck me this weekend, I was walking by a booth, and the booth was about, farmers trying to convince, get farmers to grow food the way their ancestors grew food. And they had a pledge board. Anyone could sign walk by and sign this paper to pledge to eat 50% and spend 50% of your food dollars, grocery store and restaurants, on farmers who are growing food the right way, basically. So whether that's farmers markets or like Holy Cow Beef here, but local grown, fresh, vine ripe, and all that kind of stuff. And it struck me how odd it is that we're doing this campaign and we're trying to get people to sign up to make a 50% pledge to eat 50% of your food the way human beings have eaten food for thousands of years. We have so changed our food that now we have to educate and convince and sales pitch and do a campaign and a 50% pledge drive just to try to get people to eat how humans have always eaten. It's crazy. Anyways.
Good point, though.
Here's the story. And keep in mind, what I'm talking about is the loss of resiliency. So Americans are sick. Obviously, we've talked about this lots of times. Any health category you want to look at, if you've seen any of my talks, you've seen the graphs I put up. We have the highest infant mortality rate of any industrialized country. More of our babies die than anyone else. We have the lowest life expectancy of any industrialized country. We die the youngest. If you want to look at percent of population with two or more chronic diseases, we have more people with chronic diseases than any other country. That's kids or adults. Chronic diseases, almost 50% of kids today now have a chronic disease. If you want to talk about obesity rates, cancer rates, diabetes rates, whatever, we lead the pack. And we spend the most money, take the most drugs, and do the most medical procedures to get these worst outcomes. But some of the latest slides, which I haven't shown here locally in Lubbock to anybody. This was my first time put it in a presentation, but it was from Blue Cross Blue Shield, a study they just put out, a millennial health study in 2019. And what this showed was they looked at all these different health parameters to see when do people start to decline. When does the health span curve that I talk about all the time? We want to extend our health span curve. We want to maintain health for as long as possible. When does that start to decline? Well, in millennials, the age of 27 is when health starts to go down.
27?
27 years old is when the graph takes a dive. Then they looked at kids in 2014, millennials in 2014, and compared them to 2017, different health outcomes. 8 of the top 10 conditions have had double-digit increases in prevalence in millennials from 14 to 17 in 3 years. 8 of the top 10 conditions, double-digit increases. It is crazy. Anyway, so that's some of the background to, you know, my point there. I was trying to prove, hey, we have lost our resiliency to disease.
Man.
No doubt about it.
So is that number getting younger as we go along? Or, I mean...
Yeah. Yeah, our resiliency used to be extended beyond 27, for sure.
Yeah, so it's shocking to me that it would be, you know, at 27 years old, but actually even going younger than 27.
Right. Well,
over time, I guess that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, the CDC came out a number of years ago and said the kids born after the year 2000 will be the first generation of Americans to not outlive their parents' lifespan. So our life expectancy had been just steadily climbing ever since the American Revolution, and now it's going down. So there's no doubt we've lost our resiliency. Just look around. Go to any public event, store, movie, grocery store, whatever, and look around. Everyone's sick. So here's from Dr. Price's book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. The Indians of the Yukon have long known the cure for scurvy, and history makes an important contribution to their wisdom in treating this disease. It is of interest that W.N. Kemp of Vancouver states, quote, so this is a guy in Vancouver, the earliest recorded successful treatment of scurvy occurred in Canada in 1535 when Jacques Cartier, on the advice of a friendly Indian, gave his scurvy-prostrated men a decoction of young, green, succulent shoots from the spruce trees with successful results. These happy effects apparently were not appreciated in Europe, for scurvy continued to be endemic in Europe. Since that time, untold thousands of mariners and white land dwellers have died with this dreaded disease. Shortly before our arrival in northern Canada, a white prospector had died of scurvy. Beside him was his white man's packet of canned foods. Any Indian man or woman, boy or girl, could have told him how to save his life by eating animal organs or the buds of trees. The cure to scurvy.
Yeah.
These natives knew this ancient wisdom. In 1535, the first reported case of cure of scurvy. And hundreds of years would pass before the Europeans and more civilized folks figured it out. We lost that. So this loss of wisdom started.
I thought it was all done with limes, though. That's where you got the limey, right?
Yeah, the limes did come in, but that was some many years later.
Yeah, yeah, and for the naval people.
Morley taught us sauerkraut. There's vitamin C in cabbage, but when you ferment it, the bacteria work on that cabbage, it actually increases the amount of vitamin C. So sauerkraut has, I think it was 6 times more, 10 times more vitamin C. It may have been more than that. I'll have to go back and find that.
That's
but
a lot.
Way more vitamin C than just cabbage. And that's how, I don't know if it's Magellan or one of those sailors, his men, they all lived. There's one more passage I want to read. So another illustration of the wisdom of the native Indians of that far north country came to me through 2 prospectors whom we rescued and brought out with us just before the fall freeze-up. So this is Weston Price talking about finding these prospectors. They had gone into the district which at that time was still uncharted and unsurveyed, to prospect for precious metals and radium. They were both doctors of engineering and science, which I find interesting. They were very highly educated. So they were both doctors of engineering and science and had not been sent with very elaborate equipment or had been sent with very elaborate equipment from one of the large national mining corporations. Owing to the inaccessibility of the region, they adopted a plan for reaching it quickly. They had flown across two ranges of mountains from Alaska, and when they arrived at the inside range, i.e. the Rocky Mountain Range, they found the altitude so high that their plane could not fly over the range, and as a result, they were brought down on a little lake outside. The plane then returned, but was unable to reach the outside world because of shortage of fuel. The pilot had to leave it on a waterway and trudge over the mountains to civilization. The two prospectors undertook to carry their equipment and provisions over the Rocky Mountain Range into the interior district where they were to prospect. They found the distance across the plateau to be about 100 miles and the elevation ranging up to 9,000 feet. While they had provisions and equipment to stay 2 years, they found it would take all of this time to carry their provisions and instruments across this plateau. They accordingly abandoned everything, and rather than remain in the country with very uncertain facilities and prospects for obtaining food and shelter, made a forced march to the Larrad River with the hope that some expedition might be in that territory. One of the men told me the following tragic story. While they were crossing the high plateau, he nearly went blind with so violent a pain in his eyes that he had feared he would go insane. It was not snow blindness, for they were equipped with glasses. It was xerophthalmia, due to lack of vitamin A. One day, he almost ran into a mother grizzly bear and two cubs. Fortunately, they did not attack him, but moved off. He sat down on a stone and wept in despair of ever seeing his family again. As he sat there holding his throbbing head, he heard a voice and looked up. It was an old Indian who had been tracking that grizzly bear. He recognized his prospector's plight, and while neither could understand the language of the other, the Indian, after making an examination of his eyes, took him by the hand and led him to a stream that was coursing its way down the mountain. Here, as the prospector sat waiting, the Indian built a trap of stones across the stream. He then went upstream and waded back down, splashing as he came, and thus drove the trout into the trap. He threw the fish out on the bank and told the prospector to eat the flesh of the head and the tissues back of the eyes, including the eyes, with the result that in a few hours his pain would largely subside. In 1 day, his sight was rapidly returning, and in 2 days his eyes were nearly normal. He told me with profound emotion and gratitude that the Indian had certainly saved his life. Now modern science knows that one of the richest sources of vitamin A is the entire animal body. In the entire animal body is that of the tissues back of the eyes, including the retina of the eye. The point of those two stories is there was ancient wisdom that these civilizations had. Again, I believe divine in origin, passed down through the generations, and we lost that wisdom. Why? Because of convenience and money. The root of all evil, the love of money. We started processing these foods in a different way so that they would not go rancid as easily and they could sit on a train or a ship or a wagon or a grocery store shelf for longer. We could mass produce this food and to sell more of it. I mean, that's, in my opinion, the bottom line. And that led to this loss of resiliency. So further on in the book, Dr. Price talks about how tuberculosis would run rampant in some in the communities. Like in Switzerland, there was a town where tuberculosis was killing people. And a two-hour walk down the road into the Swiss Alps, there was another village where there was no tuberculosis at all. And his conclusion was these people are resistant to tuberculosis. And he wanted to know why. How are they resistant? And his conclusion was, it's because the village up in the Swiss Alps, 2 hours down the road, was still eating the food rich in these fat-soluble vitamins, vitamin A, D, E, and K, that their ancestors had always eaten. Where the guys closer to the port could and had access to this enriched white flour, marmalade, jam, sugar, that diminished their resiliency. It diminished their immune system, made them more prone. He interviewed a doctor in Alaska. Let me see this doctor's name real quick. I think I wrote it down. Dr. Romig, R-O-M-I-G. So this was a surgeon in Alaska back in the early 1900s. And Dr. Romig said he saw very little or no malignancies in the primitives, he called them, until they moved to town, basically, and started eating the modern diet. And for TB patients, there was no cure for that at the time, no antibiotics. He sent the TB patients back into the wilderness to go back to the village and live with ancestrally, basically, go live with your people because your people don't get tuberculosis. So whatever they're doing, somehow it's helping tuberculosis. So I found that very, very interesting. So, you know, back then, the things that the body had to deal with were basically germs and trauma. If the body encountered a germ, an infection, or trauma from an accident, the cell would go into what we now call a pro-inflammatory M1 state. We've talked about M1 before with Morley Robbins. Basically, M1 is a state of function of the cell and of the mitochondria where energy production is sequestered or goes down, and you increase your exhaust, your reactive oxygen species of free radicals. Why would you do that? Well, the body's so beautifully designed, it's doing it for a reason. The reason is those free radicals are going to kill the bug. That's how your immune system kills these bugs. It actually produces hydrogen peroxide and other oxidative stressors and free radicals, reactive oxygen species, we call them. It's producing the bullets, the flame throwers, the weapons of mass destruction. The immune system is turned on. These cells are turned on to kill a bug or to burn up the traumatized tissue, because a traumatized cell is not going to function right. So the cell goes into M1 for a reason, for a purpose. When there's a stressor on it, a germ or a trauma, that's a stress, it goes into M1, it decreases energy, it increases exhaust. The exhaust kills the bugs and cleans out the hurt tissue. And then you flip. That cell flips into M2. M2 is a anti-inflammatory state, full of good chemicals that cause growth. So growth factors and stem cell stimulating chemicals, things that will rebuild, regenerate, renew, repair, and bring health and vitality back to that cell or that tissue, that organ. And that's how we're designed. That's how it works. M1 to M2, these stressors in the body traditionally would have been just a germ or a toxin. Today, we have a lot more stressors in our environment, and we've talked about them. You know, heavy metals from the mercury in the teeth. Griffin Cole went through that extensively, even though the modern dentists don't understand this because dental school doesn't train them in it. The conflict of interest with the ADA and the production of this of the silver fillings. But bottom line, the fully informed and educated curriculum's not there. So the dentists don't know, but the research is there, as Griffin Cole explained. But that's one heavy metal out of many. Everyone's heard about the lead contamination in Flint, Michigan in the water. Well, believe me, it's not just Flint, and it's not just lead that's contaminating the water. There's pesticides and herbicides. We've heard from Jeffrey Smith, who was also at the conference this weekend, in about Roundup being in the rainwater now. 70% of the rain has Roundup in it, glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup. Stephanie Seneff has talked ad nauseum about the detrimental effects of Roundup and glyphosate. We'll have to have her back on the show, because what she presented this weekend was how that glyphosate molecule is actually getting incorporated into proteins in our body, exchanging for the glycine amino acid. And when you exchange out the glycine for glyphosate, it is devastating to our human physiology. So that's a stressor on the body today. Of course, just basic stuff like sitting. Sitting's a new smoking. We haven't talked about that as much, but we have some. That's a stressor on the body. The lack of sunlight, being under man-made artificial light all the time. In fact, I presented at the conference. There's a study that showed when you lack copper in your tissues and in your cells, you don't absorb the sunlight as well. And we need to absorb the sunlight because that sets our circadian rhythm, but it also interacts with photoreceptors on your mitochondria, your carburetor. There are receptors, keyholes for photons, for particles of light. It's amazing. But we're sitting under the wrong wavelengths of light. You know, there's a number of stressors today that Weston A. Price back in the day didn't even see. The stressor, of course, that I talked about was iron fortified food. Again, man in his wisdom looked at these pregnant ladies back in the 1930s and 40s and saw that their hemoglobin was a little lower than the normal population. So in man's wisdom, they decided that's not good. We need to try to deal with this anemia, this low hemoglobin. Let's fortify the food with iron. And thus it began. And unfortunately, the type of iron that they put in is not a natural form. They put in an inorganic form. And this inorganic iron, and much of it is iron filings, metallic powder. In fact, I showed that in one of my slides. Baby formula in particular, the number one ingredient for the iron is metallic iron powders. But I want to go back to this hemoglobin thing. In pregnancy, they found these ladies were anemic. Let's give them some iron. Let's fortify the food for everybody. Well, here's what the study showed. In 1995, someone actually decided to look at natives who weren't getting iron fortified food. 150,000 live birds they looked at. And the conclusion of this study, quote, the magnitude of the fall in hemoglobin concentration in pregnancy is related to birth weight. So they saw a relationship. If your hemoglobin fell, there was a correlation to birth weight. But continue the next sentence. Failure of the hemoglobin concentration to fall below 105 grams per liter indicates an increased risk of low birth weight and preterm delivery. So, translation. Yes, the hemoglobin falls a little bit more during pregnancy. And in fact, if your hemoglobin doesn't fall a little bit more in pregnancy, you're going to be at more risk for a preterm delivery and low birth weight. That's 150,000 live birds this gentleman looked at. And this was Dr. Steer, Philip Steer. And this was a study from 1995. Academic Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Westminster Medical School, Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London. Anyways, my point is, it's normal. It's normal for some reason, the way God designed it. When a mom's carrying this fetus, the hemoglobin is going to drop some. And when it does, that's okay because it actually incurs healthier pregnancy and healthier birth weight babies. So my point is, man thinks he comes in there with his wisdom. We start to fortify the iron into the foods for everybody, not just pregnant ladies. And it turns out, when you do this, what you're doing is twofold. Not only is that a stressor on the body, it adds to the stress response of the cell, but it's also undermining your anti-stress responses, your antioxidant enzymes that go in there once the cell needs to flip into M2, put out the fire, start healing. Antioxidant enzymes are utilized for that, and iron shuts those down. So iron's going to keep you in the pro-inflammatory M1 state, low energy, high free radicals, and it's going to shut down the firemen who are supposed to put out the fire to flip you to M2 to heal. It hits both sides of the equation. That's why it's so bad for us. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to go through and quote some of these studies that I presented at the conference, you know, explaining more about how this iron, once it's in you, it never comes out unless you bleed, and how stored iron is so detrimental to our health. So, and I believe it's the number one reason, besides lack of peace, which we'll get into also, for the loss of resiliency in our physical bodies. So stick with us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580, Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, right here on the show. All right, we'll continue on. So you were going to get into reasons why.
Yeah, and basically what I did was try to go back and listen to all 20-plus radio shows with Morley. I've done some videos with him. He sent me hundreds of articles via email.
Oh, yeah.
And basically I tried to summarize that 2 years' worth of stuff into one-hour presentation. So the essence is, and that's what I'm going to run through here real quick, is just try to make this case that this excess iron is a very detrimental thing, obviously, but it's the underpinning of what's keeping our resiliency from thriving. So obviously iron's important for life. Hemoglobin, that's the protein inside your red blood cell that carries your oxygen. Hemoglobin's full of iron. Mm-hmm. So we need that. 80% of iron in the body is in this hemoglobin, in the red blood cell. And the red blood cells die, you know, every 90 to 120 days. They die. You recycle them. You get that iron out of them and put it back to your bone marrow to make more blood cells. And you're constantly turning over and making more red blood cells. Myoglobin in the muscle, there's some iron in that. There's a few enzymes like cytochrome P450. So, I mean, iron is needed for sure. No doubt about it. However, iron's also highly toxic if it's not in the right form, the right dose, and properly chaperoned. And the key thing for people to understand, this is where doctors really get off, is the iron that's in your blood. When you do a blood test, look for your iron level. That could be all over the place. It could be normal, it could be low, it could be high. But none of that correlates with what's in your tissue. So lots of people, their blood work looks okay-ish. Really, their doctor's probably not even looking at their iron level. But your iron can look totally fine and normal in the blood, and you be completely saturated in the tissues. There is not a test that will tell you, not a readily available test. You can do a muscle biopsy, and you can do a really expensive special MRI that's really only available in the research labs for iron in the tissue. But practically speaking, there's no real way to measure the iron in your tissue, so therefore you just don't know. So my general rule of thumb is if you've eaten a standard American diet for any number of years growing up and you have not had some major bleeding episode, like you were in a bad car wreck and lost a ton of blood, or you've had very, very heavy menstrual cycles repeatedly for many years, or you've had tons of gastrointestinal bleeding from an ulcer or ulcerative colitis or something like that. I mean, a consistent long-term bleeding, then it's possible you don't have iron in your tissue. Or if you consistently donate blood out of your civic duty, you do it every 30, you know, every quarter or something, then possibly you don't have too much iron. But pretty much everyone else does.
Well, what about this on the text line? Says, well, what do you think about being a regular plasma donor?
No, that doesn't get the iron out. You got to do whole blood.
Okay. That's a good question, though. Thank you, Mike.
So so iron is needed, but here's a study. This is from 2014, February 9th of 2014, Journal of Research Medical Science. A dietary intake of iron is needed to replace the iron that's lost in the stool and in the urine, as well as through the skin. So in a day, you're normally going to just naturally slough off some skin cells in your colon, on your skin, in your bladder. You'll naturally lose a little that way from sloughing. The loss represents approximately 0.9 milligrams of iron for an adult male and 0.8 milligrams for an adult female. So we'll just round that up to 1 milligram is roughly what you're just naturally going to lose in a day. There's otherwise no known excretory pathway for iron. The body cannot say, hey, I've got too much iron, I need to dump it and trigger a pathway to dump iron. There isn't one. There's no known mechanism to dump iron out of the body. You naturally lose a milligram a day. Okay, so how much iron do you need in a day? Well, the red blood cell that I mentioned, red blood cells die and you make new ones every day. Well, those are millions and millions that are dying every day, and you're going to recycle. So you got to make millions and millions of red blood cells every day. It turns out you need about 25 milligrams of iron today to make all the new red blood cells for tomorrow. 25 milligrams today is what you need. 24 of those 25 milligrams you're going to get from recycling the old red blood cells. We are a great recycler of iron. So that's awesome. We need 25 milligrams a day. We recycle 24. We're losing that one. So we need, you know, 1-2 milligrams of iron a day dietarily. So I've quoted this before. Multigrain Cheerios, flip it over, read the label. 17 milligrams of iron in one cup of Cheerios because it's fortified. The fortified grains are full. And no one eats just a cup. So if you eat two cups or more, which most people would do, that's, let me do the math, 34 milligrams of iron when you need one or two. And that's not counting if you had some red meat, and the red meat and some vegetables have iron also, but all those are in the 1 to 3 to 4 milligram range, and that's great. But you eat this iron fortified food, you're going to have excess. Here's another study. This is, quote, in the United States, most dry infant cereals are fortified with a metallic iron powder, specifically electrolytic iron. So here's the next study from Annals of Nutritional Metabolism, 2001. This is by Klaus Schumann. Quote, homeostatic mechanisms increase intestinal iron absorption in iron deficiency. What that means is when you are actually iron deficient, the body flips on a switch to increase intestinal iron absorption. You'll actually grab more iron out of your food and bring it into the body when you need it, when you're iron deficient. And continuing in the article, quote, but its downregulation at high intake levels seems insufficient to prevent accumulation of high iron stores at high intake. There is no regulated iron excretion in overload. So what that's saying is when you put too much iron into your gut, the downregulation of absorption doesn't work very well. We can't downregulate that well, and we actually just soak it in. So you're going to eat that bowl of Cheerios with 34 milligrams of iron. You're going to soak most of that in even when you don't need it. That's what this article's saying. And it does mention there's no known excretory mechanism. So what I'm getting at is if you've eaten the standard American diet, you soaked it in even when you didn't need it, and there's no way to get it out, so it's still in you. I haven't had a bowl of Cheerios in probably 8 years since I learned more truth in medicine and nutrition. But so that would have put me in my mid-30s. So that's a whole lot of bowls of Cheerios and Wheaties and Total, and all the cereals have it. And all the wheat, basically. Enriched white flour, if that's what it says on the ingredient label, it's enriched with iron. So here's another study, Mechanisms of Iron Loading and Toxicity, Gregory Anderson, American Journal of Hematology, from 2007. The body has no known mechanism for the active excretion of iron. Continued excessive iron uptake is followed by iron deposition in various tissues, ultimately leading to tissue damage and possibly end organ failure. That is Dr. Lingo for death. Here's a study, iron fortified cereals increase inflammation. So this was a study by Jing Lu. Let me see the year here, journal. December 6th of 2016. Plus online, plus one online journal. Conclusion, iron fortified cereals. So what they did was looked at rural poor kids who were fed iron enriched cereals. Iron fortified to see if it would help their anemia levels. That's the point of this study. Iron fortified cereal improved iron status of poor rural toddlers, but was also associated with systemic inflammation, which was likely to impair their growth. So we threw this excess metallic filing, inorganic iron, into the cereal, and the kids ate it, and it increased their inflammation and stunted their growth. Did it put more iron in them? Yes, it did. And how did they measure that? Ferritin. Ferritin's a storage locker for iron, and their storage locker of iron in this study, those kids' ferritin levels went up. And we've talked on the show many times, you don't want ferritin to go up. You don't want to have extra storage of iron, and when you are so full of extra iron inside your cell, the ferritin dumps into the blood. Then you are super over plump, over ripened with iron when it's in your blood. And that's what they measured in this study. These kids were just overflowing with iron. Here's a review article from Jerry Sullivan, 2004. Is stored iron safe? That's the question. And I'm just going to, one quote, antioxidant and anti-inflammatory processes may operate optimally only in the absence of stored iron. So that's getting back to M1 versus M2. M2 is the antioxidant, anti-inflammatory processes. Those don't work, or to quote Jerry Sullivan, they work optimally only in the absence of stored iron. Another study, Annual Review of Nutrition from 2010. This is Marianne Wieslick-Resnick. Quote, "It has long been recognized that iron levels must be tightly regulated to provide an essential nutrient, which it is, that is involved in oxygen delivery, metabolism, and redox regulation while guarding against excessive levels of a primary toxicant that can generate reactive oxygen species to produce cellular damage and death." So she's saying what I just said at the outset. This is tightly regulated because it's an essential nutrient, but it's also a toxin if it's not tightly regulated and if you get too much of it. Going on in the article, a large body of clinical evidence demonstrates disease susceptibility and the response to infection and inflammation worsen with elevated iron stores. The relationship between iron overload and infectious diseases are particularly well documented. Tuberculosis, she talks about, and goes on to talk about lots of other bugs. Basically, when you have too much iron, you're more susceptible to these bugs. Going on in the article, quote, "In general, iron deficiency confers relative resistance to infection." When you're iron deficient, you're more resistant to infection, with high iron status promoting the disease state. Inflammatory chronic disease are also profoundly influenced by iron status. Increased iron stores are correlated with markers of chronic inflammation and other well-established risk factors of diabetes, obesity, and metabolic syndrome, atherosclerosis, neurodegeneration, and chronic liver disease are frequently associated with iron loading. This growing body of evidence is significant not only due to the prevalence of chronic diseases in modern society, but also because modified dietary iron or manipulation of iron status could represent simple preventative or therapeutic avenues. For example, improvement has been found upon reduction of iron stores in diabetics by phlebotomy, that's blood donation, or by iron chelation, suggesting new approaches to disease management. It is worth noting that iron chelation and deprivation also has been applied in cancer therapy as well. I mean, it's article after article. Nagamori, out of Japan, in 2015, the activation of the NLRP3 inflammasome by cellular labile iron. That's a bunch of scientific lingo. We've talked about this NLRP3 before. This is the trigger on the gun. This is what's pulling the trigger. NLRP3 is the trigger for inflammatory cascade in the body. And what this article is saying, Nagamori is saying, is iron, excess iron pulls the trigger. So, and I didn't get into a study that talked about how excess iron is actually feeding cancer cells. It's feeding candida, the bugs that we chase, these tick-borne bugs, Lyme, co-infections of Lyme, Epstein-Barr virus, candida, feeds them. I read one article that said cancer cells are addicted to iron. It showed biopsies of breast cancer cells. And then they compared them to the normal cells right next door. The breast cancer cell had 5 times more iron in it than the normal cell right next to it. So these bugs feed off excess iron. Cancer feeds off excess iron. Your detox enzymes are compromised and shut down by excess iron. Cellular energy production is compromised and shut down by excess iron. Cellular exhaust cleanup mechanisms, your air filter, your antioxidant enzymes, shut down by excess iron. All of this translates to your rusting from the inside out. One of the slides I showed is free radicals, oxidative stress, and disease. And basically the point of the slide was, which diseases are associated with rusting, with oxidative stress? All of them. Every disease you can think of. They were all on the list.
Wow.
So what's the antidote to this? Obviously quit eating this fortified iron. Donate some blood quarterly. As long as your hemoglobin, which is your blood protein in your red blood cell that carries your oxygen, as long as that stays at an adequate level, go donate blood as often as you can. The blood bank will love to have it. Every 60 days is what they'll do. Now, if you have a condition where they rejected you at the blood bank, and there are a number of conditions where they will reject you for safety reasons, then you've got to have a doctor write a prescription for a therapeutic phlebotomy. That's the only other way to do it. A doctor's not going to write a prescription for a therapeutic phlebotomy unless your ferritin, probably most doctors would wait till your ferritin's above 300 to write you that prescription. Well, ferritin, again, is an intracellular storage locker. Ferritin should only be inside your cells. It's where you're going to put a little extra iron that you get in, save it for a rainy day, save it for a day when you cut yourself with a chainsaw when you're cleaning up the brush lot out there. You need to be able to grab that iron and make more blood when you're in trauma, when you have a bleed. So we do need ferritin to be full of iron stored inside our cell. The problem is when you get too much of it and you don't have bioavailable copper, because copper is what moves this iron in and out of storage. Copper moves iron into your red blood cell so you can make more red blood. Copper is needed for that square dance. Iron's got to be recycled. Copper's needed for the recycling. So if the copper's not there and if you have excess iron, you're going to have too much in storage. That ferritin's going to dump out of the cell into the blood. Sir Douglas Kell, University of Manchester, we quote him all the time, the world's leading authority on ferritin, said your blood level of ferritin should be zero. You shouldn't have storage lockers of iron floating around in your blood, this ferritin molecule. That should be inside your cells. Anytime there's ferritin in the blood, it's a problem. You have excess iron at that point. But unfortunately, doctors aren't taught this in school. The research is outpacing the education curriculum. So doctors wait until your ferritin in your blood is over 300 before they'll write you a prescription for a therapeutic phlebotomy. That's a big problem. It's my goal for 2020 is to come up with a very convincing set of medical studies to convince these doctors from around the country to go ahead and write for a therapeutic phlebotomy for these patients who cannot donate blood. It would be life-saving. I ran into a lady at the conference. She's in tears, crying. She's in California. Her doctor won't write her a prescription because I know there's laws, I'm sure, in California for doctors to hamstring them if you're not totally in line with whatever parameter they're going to get you. But bottom line, she donates blood. She is able to donate blood, and she feels so much better for the few days after that blood donation, and then she crashes and burns again. She is so overloaded with iron, it's causing excessive itchiness and joint pain to the point of she's miserable and wants to commit suicide. I mean, it was awful. This lady's crying on my shoulder at the conference, and she's probably going to move to Lubbock just so she can get these therapeutic phlebotomies done. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyways, my point is, unfortunately, most doctors don't know this, so it's going to be hard if you can't donate blood at the blood bank. But at least quit eating it. You could ask your doctor to check your blood. You know, just check your cholesterol. Go get your cholesterol checked and your blood sugar checked every week if he'll let you and if your insurance will cover it. But even if they won't, pay cash. It'd be worth it. Because even one vial at a time, I mean, any amount could be beneficial. And then we're running out of time, so just a brief word on copper. I've kind of already mentioned it. Bioavailable copper, which is found in organ meats and whole food vitamin C and bee pollen, oysters and shellfish. Unfortunately, copper's not too much in the vegetables anymore because of the way we farm. But you've got to have this iron to deal. I mean, you've got to have the copper to deal with the iron. Copper's in charge of the absorption of iron from the gut, the transport of iron around the body, the release of iron from storage vaults, putting the iron into your red blood cell, all that. You need copper. And when you don't have the copper, then the iron can't be recycled. And it gets stuck inside your cell and eventually just overflows out into your tissues. So you got to have the bioavailable copper. We've talked about that a lot. Ferrooxidase is that enzyme where copper sits to do its work. And so it's a very, very important thing to have this ferrooxidase. I showed a picture of a Swiss Army knife that's all worth every component closed. And that's ferrooxidase when there's no copper. It can't function. It can't work. Then I showed the next slide was a picture of this huge, I mean, it's a massive Swiss Army knife. But with all the gizmos and all the attachments, all the different tools extended out. I'll show Wade here since he's in the audience.
Oh, cool.
But when it's extended out and it can actually function, that's copper. That's when copper is in the ferrooxidase. Now ferrooxidase can go do its job. And there's 24 different known functions of ferrooxidase. And one of those is to move this iron thing around. And what kicks copper out of ferrooxidase is all the things we've talked about so many times. High fructose corn syrup, antibiotics, birth control pills, synthetic vitamin D, synthetic vitamin C. So you need to try to eat natural forms of copper, and then you need to try to reduce your exposures to those things I just mentioned, high fructose corn syrup, antibiotics, birth control, synthetic D, and synthetic C, so that this pocket knife can be opened and extended and function and work and escort iron around appropriately and get it out of your tissues.
And how do you get whole food vitamin C from the text line? Whole food vitamin, or what?
Yeah,
is
not
whole
the
food
store. A lot of people at the conference get confused. I'm not talking about the grocery store Whole Foods. I mean, a vitamin. You can get a supplement that is from food that are rich in vitamin C. I mean, you can eat the food, and I encourage you to. Bell peppers, all peppers, really. The dark berries, any colorful vegetable is going to have vitamin C. The problem is, as that produce sits on the shelf, it loses vitamin C. There's a study Dr. Day, we interviewed years ago or a couple years ago, quoted green beans lose 77% of their vitamin C in 1 week of sitting on the shelf.
Wow.
So try to eat it, but try to eat right out of your garden, and you get it that way. Otherwise, we have one. It's whole food vitamin C in a bottle, and it's just a capsule that's they got all this all these vegetables and vine ripe and stuff and juiced them and got the powder out of, you know, evaporate the water, get the powder, put in a capsule. So we've got one. Innate Response has one. Pure Synergy has one. But the grocery store vitamin C's, those are going to be straight ascorbic acid. That's not what you want because it doesn't have the copper. We're going after the copper. I mean, vitamin C has lots of other good things in it. But so get on VeritasMarket.com and get the whole food vitamin C that's on there. You know, the rest of my presentation we don't have time for. I just went through all the top diseases, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, MS, diabetes, obesity, and showed how iron, all these different studies that directly correlate this excess iron to these different diseases. So, again, I think I'll give this presentation where people can see the slides and get the whole meal deal. Sometime in the coming weeks, I'll try to find a location to do that and get it announced and people can come listen to it because it's really important. We really need to know this. It is the underpinning. It's the Occam's razor, all things being equal. The simplest solution tends to be the best one, and that's a problem. This is just too simple. Go donate some blood, eat real food, and get your copper back. I mean, it's amazing what that can do. So I encourage people to continue to get educated. You're the cure. Your body can be resilient and resistant to disease, just like Weston A. Price found. To be a modern person today, it's almost a death sentence. It's definitely a sick sentence. You're going to be sick if you're not purposely trying to live like your ancestors. So go do that. You be the cure. Thanks for being with us today.
Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, everybody. Check out the website, VeritasMedical.com. VeritasMedical, all one word, .com. Dr. Edwards, have a great rest of the week. We'll see you back here next week on You're the Cure.